You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Welcome you all very, very much. It's wonderful to see this room so full, and I know that it's overflowing. And welcome, a very warm welcome to the panelists. All four of them. We have a really outstanding panel: Lord Nicholas Stern, Professor Stiglitz, and then we have a representative from the World Bank, Ian Perry, and then we have we have Adele Morris, who's leading the whole day, in a way, because this is a day of launching a Brookings-wide cooperative effort on climate and energy across all departments, all parts of Brookings. So it's a very special day, and thank you all very much. Before introducing the panelists, let me just note that Lord Stern and Joe Stiglitz are co-chairs of the High-Level Commission on Carbon Prices. The commission is in turn supported by the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, which was created by the World Bank. Minister Ségolène Royal from France, who is co-chair of the CPLC, regrettably could not participate. She was trying to make it, but somehow the plane was too late to fit it in. But she sends her best regards and wishes of success. Adele Morris is senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings, where she directs the Climate and Energy Economics Project. She was a senior economist at the U.S. Congress, worked at U.S. Treasury as a chief natural resource economist, and also worked for a while as a lead U.S. negotiator on land use and forestry issues as part of the climate change treaty process. She held several government positions prior to that. So, Adele, a really warm thanks to you, because you took a lot of leadership, a lot of hard work to get us to this point today. Thank you very much. Harmon Perry, is that the right name? Ian Perry, okay. He's principal environment fiscal policy expert in the IMF Fiscal Affairs Department. Before joining the fund in 2010, he held the Alan Neese Chair in Environmental Economics at Resources for the Future. He co-authored the 2014 very important IM working paper, How Much Carbon Pricing is in Countries' Own Interests, the Critical Role of Co-Benefits. And over lunch, this was touched upon. It's a global issue. It's a global public good. I think Nick Stern called the issues around climate once the biggest market failure in history. But there is also something very local about it. And to stress the local benefits, which have positive global spillover effects, was your topic, and I think is now today a very important part of the whole discussion, and is very helpful. Lord Nicholas Stern is IJ Patel Professor of Economics and Government and Chair of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. Since 2013, Nick has been President of the British Academy. In addition to many other positions, he co-chairs the Global Commission for the Economy and the Climate. Now, sorry, I get lost a little bit in all the commissions that exist, but there are a few. Nick was chief economist at the World Bank and at the EBRD, and I had the privilege to have an office very close to Nick, so that's where we started to know each other. We knew each other from before, but we got to know each other better. While at the UK Treasury, Nick headed the 2006 Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change. And I think that really was a turning point in the whole debate. There was always a group of people who worried about climate, who knew about the issues, but the economics profession broadly defined pretty much ignored it. I do remember being part of a commission created by the World Bank. We had our first meeting, I think it was in 2005, on long-term growth. And there were very eminent people, ex-ministers. Robert Solow was a member, Nobel Prize winners, and so on. And we had a one-day meeting in New York on growth. And nobody, including myself, I mean, you know, I was just as guilty as all others, mentioned climate and climate change. This was 2005. So it's fairly recent that this has become really a mainstream topic in the economics profession and in the also in the geostrategic sphere and politics. And I think Nick's, the Stern Review, the way it's, as it is called, was the turning point. I mean, it was the moment when the profession started really focusing on the issue with very controversial articles on discount rates and things like that. I'll come back to that for a minute. Nick has written a new book. His latest book is Why Are We Waiting? The Logic, Urgency, and Promise of Tackling Climate Change. So, Nick, thanks a lot for being here. And then Joe Stiglitz needs absolutely no introduction, but he will still get some introduction. Joe has been active on this for years and has joined forces with Nick in heading this commission. He is professor at Columbia University and is also the chief economist of the Roswell Institute. Among his many positions, he is co-founder and co-president of the Initiative for Policy Dialogue, which helps emerging countries, developing countries, in their policy dialogue with the rest of the world. It's just those countries, right? It's restricted to the emerging and developing countries. And he also co-chairs the OECD's high-level expert group on the measurement of economic performance and social progress. Joe was a chief economist at the World Bank, and at that time he was my boss, indirectly at least, and I have very fond memories of that. And also, of course, he headed the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors. He was awarded the Nobel Prize, his Nobel Laureate of 2001 in economics. Joe has written widely on globalization, inequality, growth, development. I think it says here much more, and I think that's the good way to put it, because if I started continuing, it would take quite a bit of time. His most recent book is The Euro, How a Common Currency Threatens the Future of Europe. And we've had some discussions on that book. And I haven't read I read bits and pieces, but I'm glad to report that it's not what I would call an anti-Europe book or anti-Euro book, but it contains some constructive suggestions of how to salvage the project. And salvaging the project, I think, means a lot in today's world, geostrategically and for including for energy and climate questions. I just realized this morning that the UK had declared elections in June the 8th. Next Sunday, there are elections in France. The German elections have to be held, I think, before the end of September. And the Italian elections will have to be held, I think, in November at the latest, perhaps earlier. So we have the four largest and founding, three of them founding members of the European Commission, the European Union project, really having elections at a time when the US just had its own election, of course, very momentously important elections, and where the debate on energy, climate, growth, the future of work, unemployment, and development are very big topics, and they're all interwoven. I don't want to take too much time, but I do want to kind of briefly explain how I came to the topic, I think how many economists got to the topic. And of course, as a caricature wrong caricature to say to start with, but as a caricature, is you have a multi-sector growth model with production functions, demand functions, constraints, and so on, and an objective function which you minimize, which is weighted sum of the weighted by time sum of the income, or you can weight it differently, but by some kind of income welfare or economic satisfaction in the objective function. And that did not usually include environmental sustainability per se, or environmental quality of life per se. And also, these models didn't have carbon as an input. And therefore, the whole climate issue was not part of this model. And I think the early discussions were very simplistic in a sense, but naturally, because that's where growth theories kind of came from, you introduce a new constraint, namely a carbon budget of some sort, with a new input into the production functions, which cannot be used in an unlimited way because it has some negative effects on production, consumption, quality of life, and components of the welfare function. So when you introduce a new and binding constraint into a multi-year growth model, be it a linear growth model or a non-linear model, you have, first of all, a shadow price for that constraint that there emerges. And second, you lower the objective function. In other words, there is a cost. You cannot introduce new constraints and not have costs. And a lot of the early debate was about the size of these costs, the distribution over time, and of course also the distribution over place. And it took the profession quite a while to start thinking of it somewhat differently, and nobody contributed more to that, I think, than Nick and Joe did. And of course, what's missing from the simple model are learning effects, endogenous technology changes, which are brought about by the price of the newly scarce input. And also what's missing is the fact of the incentives, not just the learning effects, but the incentives that future prices have on today's R&D expenditure and today's investments. And because these are very long-term investments for many of them, particularly energy and urban, which together account for a huge amount of the carbon we're talking about, it changes the whole nature of the problem. The other side of the debate is regulation versus prices, but that in a way is less essential, I think, than to realize that the original kind of framework that the economists had in their mind was missing this very important technological learning and projection effect. And I'm still sometimes surprised when corporations who are really, you know, hard players when it comes to profit maximization and so on, seem to be behaving in a way that is much more, how shall I say, socially benevolent. Not all of them, of course, but many of them in the area of climate and energy. And I think there, another thing that has changed, I don't think there's agreement in the science on exact numbers. There are always ranges. Nick Stern has taught me that. And these ranges are probabilities. You know, if you keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial times, this is what the range emissions that this is compatible with, and so on. But what is now becoming, I would say, as certain as one can be in science in general, because nothing is 100% certain, but you know, it's very, very high level of certainty, is that there is in fact a cost. This is not a figment of the imagination, that it is linked to human activity, to urbanization, to energy, to forestry, to land use, and so on. And that sometime in the not too distant future, these costs will become substantial, and some of them we are already observing today in some areas. There's debate as to how much is due to climate change versus how much is due to cyclical phenomenon. You know, there's not a wide agreement, full agreement on what is caused exactly by what. But I think 95% of people who have at all studied the topic and thought about the topic, far from being experts, know that in the future there is going to be either a shadow price in terms of regulations and so on, or an actual price of carbon. And that, I think, has led to a major shift in the behavior of the private sector, Because if you know that this is going to happen in the future, even if you don't know the details and the amount, there is a very real incentive to change your behavior now. And there's an incentive even to be first mover. If you can develop technologies that reduce carbon emissions and protect climate more rapidly than others, your profits are likely to go up, and you're able to compete much more strongly against your competitors who have not done this and who have not realized that. So while there's a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of the exact numbers and the exact paths, there's very little uncertainty that of the direction we're heading for. And I think this is the paradigm shift, you know, that has taken place from the simple linear programming model or a non-linear programming model, where the whole emphasis was really on the discount rate you put in the objective function. There were many, many articles debating the size of the discount rate. That's a part of the story, but it's become, in fact, a much smaller part of the story. The bigger part of the story is the learning effect and the possibilities, the incentives, and the market effects of knowing that something like that is going to happen. So I thought, as somebody who's not in the field, who's not studied this in great detail, but as an economist, that was my kind of intellectual journey, so to speak, from where I am today compared to 10 years ago, where I thought the discount rate was really the critical variable. And last point, shadow prices are important. I mean, actual prices are better, and they will guide resources more surely. But if people have some confidence that shadow prices reflect future likelihoods, then shadow prices can influence behavior right now, even if there isn't an actual price. So anyway, these were some of the thoughts that I wanted to express. I hope that we are at a turning point here, and I do agree with those who say that the U.S. has to be absolutely part of it. I don't think one can move this forward very much without U.S., and U.S. broadly defined. I just don't mean just the federal government, but American cities, business, NGOs, and so on and so forth, because then the gaming aspects of the whole story become very negative. In other words, everybody waits on the other to move, and with the U.S. being the strongest and by far the most powerful country, and also the in terms of GDP at market prices still the largest economy, it would be very hard to move very very much forward without the U.S. So I very much hope that the U.S. will remain as it is now, not only part of the Paris Agreement, but also in terms of behavior, some of the best technologies that are being developed, some of the best examples that are being set are actually set in the U.S. And so building on that, I think there's a lot to hope for. But I do believe the story is complicated. What Nick and Joe are great at, among others also, is to simplify it in such a way that the average citizen can understand it. Because if it's not understood, then a future danger is something that people tend to ignore or don't want to think about. Okay, with these words, I'll ask Nick first and then Joe to make a small presentation of about 7 to 8 minutes or so each, and then we'll all sit around here and start debate in a kind of panel debate into which we'll bring the audience after the first few questions to the panel itself. But thank you, and I also have to single out one more person, probably many more person that I'm forgetting, but one more person, my colleague, my friend, Amar Bhattacharya, who has worked relentlessly to make this happen, to bring the various pieces together, to bring the various organizations together, private, public, municipal, federal, and whom I think, quite honestly, all of us who are interested in this topic, we owe Amar a lot. So thank you, Amar. Thank you very much. Nick, I cede you the chair here.
Thank you, Kemal, for a very thoughtful introduction, which raises a lot of questions, which I hope we'll go into in the discussion. But at a very headline level, what you were describing is dynamic public economics. Dynamic public economics. Public economics as if time mattered. Pace, urgency is the essence here because it's the cumulative total of emissions that counts. Public economics in the sense that people's learning, people's understanding of issues change, and indeed public policy should think about how to induce changes in that learning. Dynamic public economics in the sense that any kinds of evaluations of gains in the future versus gains now are going to depend very strongly on how well off you think you might be in the future relative to how well off you might think now. So anybody who talks about the discount rate goes straight to the bottom of the class, because what matters is that there are many discount rates depending on not only obviously the good that you look at, but also what kinds of circumstances you imagine for the future. And those, of course, are, if you excuse the words, intensely endogenous. The risks that we run depend on what we do now. So all the things you raised, Kemal, are at the heart of this story. And just as a headline, it's about dynamic public economics. And we have to learn there's not going to be one model that's going to drive dynamic public economics, but there are going to be a range of careful arguments, some of which involve explicit models that are going to drive that story through. And Joe's going to say something about that after I'm done, because what I'm going to try to do is to move very quickly through where we are now on our... It always makes me laugh, but it's a high-level commission on... Now, you wouldn't want to be a low-level commission on carbon pricing. That's who we are. We were invited, Joe and I, to chair this... commissioned by Ségolène Royal and Fika Sibesma, and who are the co-chairs of the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. We've had the real blessing of a very strong secretariat with John Room and Stefan Hallgate and Celine and others involved, and we're very grateful to them for all the work that they've done. And thank you again, Amara and Adele and Brookings, for your support and advice and guidance. And of course, Adele is part of the commission. So that's the commission. I won't go through all the names. I think they're on the last slide anyway, which I'll leave up. But they go from, you know, Mali to China and Brazil to Chicago and so on. So it's a very broad, but nobody represents anybody other than themselves. So that's the commission. That's who asked us to be a commission. So let's start with the question. I used to attend Nicky Caldor and Joan Robinson's lectures in Cambridge in the 1960s, and Joan Robinson always thought it was original to say, what's the question? But it does matter. What is the question? So our question is, what kinds of pricing structures, varying over space, varying over assumptions, varying over time, so we talk about corridors of prices, what kinds of prices, coupled with sensible, reasonably wise other policies? We also asked the question, what prices do you need if they're not so wise? But what kind of prices could be expected to induce changes in emissions through behavior, investment, and so on, consistent with staying well below 2 degrees? So how do you use prices to deliver on Paris in shorthand is what we were asked to do, and it is important. Note that expressing it that way, it indicates straight away that we are not examining or discussing the social cost of carbon as measured by the kinds of social damages that an extra ton of carbon would bring to the world. That itself, of course, is enormously dependent on what kind of path you think you're going to follow for the reasons I've already discussed. That's not where we are, but we observe in an appendix that because most modelings of the social cost of carbon. Most modellings used in the estimation of social cost of carbon leave out so much of what really matters in terms of risks that one can say that whatever numbers they come up with, they are very serious underestimates of what that might be. We leave the question there and we put it in an appendix because it wasn't the question we were asked. Whatever the interest in that question, and there is an interest in that question, but that's not the question that we had. Why we don't dissect the Paris Agreement and wonder too much about why people did it and whether they should have done, I actually think they did it for very good reason. Just this one slide here is that why did it come about? Well, obviously an understanding that these risks of climate change, even though you can't be precise, were potentially immense, existential for many. That the promises put on the table in terms of the nationally determined contributions, the indications of where countries would be in 2030 on their current plans, where they try to do something for this challenge, fall way short of what's necessary in terms of reductions for 2 degrees or well below 2 degrees. So a recognition of why it matters, a recognition that we're falling short in terms of current plans, as embodied in the Paris Agreement, a recognition that this involves very radical change. The world economy will double in the next 20 years or so, infrastructure will more than double, and in that time, we have to reduce total emissions absolutely by about 20%. So that's an indication of just how big these changes would have to be. But it's many of us take the view they're feasible, they're exciting, they're attractive, they bring other things with it. And not only is climate policies, if done well, consistent with growth and development and poverty reduction, but there is potentially, if we're able to realise it, a rather attractive growth story there, a kind of growth that is much more attractive indeed than that which involves cities where you can't move and breathe and ecosystems that collapse. So that's enough on why we did it all as a world, and we did do it all as a world, nearly 200 countries in Paris in December 2015, an agreement that applies to everybody. We start also with a clear understanding that economic incentives matter, no matter how much you go on about market imperfections, and we do, because they're important here, not just the imperfection in the greenhouse gas externality, but also around capital markets, networks, R&D and learning, clearly important market imperfections there. Given all that, it is still true that prices are very important incentives, and a carbon price is a very important incentive. It is obviously deeply mad to pursue fossil fuel subsidies at a time when you ought to be increasing carbon prices. And also we take a reasonably broad view of a carbon price and recognise that shadow pricing in public sector activity can be very important, and internal pricing in firms can be very important. We don't dwell on those. We do note them and emphasise their importance. We're talking mostly about carbon prices. So carbon prices are at the centre of the story, although they're not the only thing at the centre of the story of inducing change on the scale that's necessary. Packages will come together. I've already indicated other important externalities such as R&D, networks, capital markets, and of course the immense potential co-benefits of reduced pollution. So there will be part of packages. Those packages will vary across countries because the challenges in different countries are different, the endowments in different countries are different, the price of complementary resources are different. Those are all reasons why policy package to induce the kind of change that we're talking about would vary across country. At the same time, support from one country to another, and it doesn't have to be all one way from rich to poor countries, but that will be a big part of the story. International cooperation and support will be very important in this story, and the overall efficiency globally of carbon reductions is important. The ability to make the very big investments that we're describing here would involve quite a lot of support in some circumstances. So having set that up in terms of what question we're asking about carbon prices, why other policies will matter, but what are our lines of evidence on what those carbon prices could be? Well, one is to look at what kind of prices, given what we know or given what we might anticipate about technologies, what kind of prices could induce a switch? And there's quite a lot of evidence now on that. The second body of evidence has been quite a lot of detailed studies. You know, the deep decarbonization pathways was one of those, but quite a lot of national studies about what's involved. In my own country, United Kingdom, the Climate Change Committee looks very carefully at what kinds of changes might be involved, and embedded in those stories will be some carbon prices. And the third route is the sort of rather global integrated assessment models. They can be helpful on their in terms of looking at coherence across different assumptions across the world, but they suffer a big defect in the sense that they can't easily cope with learning, which is at the heart of the story, and they can't easily cope with economies of scale. It's one of the really big problems of general equilibrium modelling ever since, for a very long time, that dealing with learning and dealing with economies of scale is very hard to put into those models. Sometimes it doesn't matter all that much. This time, in this context, it matters enormously. So they're the third, not the first, of the places that we go. Now, what about the pattern over time? Well, there are quite a lot of quite difficult issues involved in the pattern over time. There's the simple sort of hotelling story of the optimal exploitation of natural resources, which looks at discounting over time. It looks at rising marginal costs as you try to extract, and those have some relevance here and point to rising prices over time. But learning is very important. How do you introduce strong learning? Learning is at the heart of the story. How do you give a clear, strong signal that this really is the direction that you're going in? Well, one answer to that question would be to bump up prices quickly and strongly, and people will really see that there's a powerful incentive. Another way around would be to promise to have prices rising over time so that people see an incentive that way. You can argue it both ways. I tilt a little bit towards the former, because telling people that prices are going to rise steadily over time and then having lots of people lobbying you so that they don't is a scenario that you can imagine. And being a European, it's a scenario that we've observed. So you can tell those stories either way, but in thinking about prices over time, you have to think about the hoteling, rising marginal extraction costs sort of arguments. You have to think of learning and economies of scale kind of arguments. And you have to think of bringing people with you and credibility stories as well. They all count, and you have to think about those things. There's not one formulaic answer to increasing over time and where you start. But I think we inclined a little bit to the story that you have to move strongly now because we're so far away from where we need to be, and then move upwards over time. Having said that they vary across places, I think it's important to recognise that the signalling efficiency role of prices is an important one. And if the world as a whole does all this well, you might expect a few decades from now to see carbon prices starting to come into or towards a common value. Now, what do you do with the money? Well, it depends where you are. In some places, taxation is a word that drives people to, throw tea into harbours and that sort of things. In other parts of the world, people think of it as an essential element in a responsible state that has lots to do to invest in education, infrastructure. Opinions vary, right? You can see where I stand, but the you do have to ask what to do with the revenues, because you do. It is important. I mean, you can just use them to pay down the debt if that's what you want to do. But you can't leave that question completely hanging. And so whilst we don't, as it were, major on that question. We do point out the different possibilities and suggest that in different circumstances they'll have different attractiveness. So you wouldn't expect all countries to do the same thing. I mean, reducing other taxes, particularly distortive taxes, particularly in a progressive way, if you can, would be one way. Helping to manage the change in terms of poor people or managing vested interests. You know, you sometimes think vested interests don't deserve to be managed, but you do have to. That's a fact of life, and that's a story which you can't discard. And, of course, R&D and learning are terribly important in this whole story, as is investment in infrastructure, and sustainable infrastructure is the heart of all this, as I hope I made clear right at the beginning. Complementary policies. Well, I've already alluded to the many other market failures which are fiercely relevant in this context, but in this slide here we emphasize what those other policies might be. I won't go into all the detail. You know, efficiency standards, R&D, land and forest management, trying to get capital markets to cope better with risk in the longer term. Critically important here because high cost of capital not only deters investment as a whole, it changes the nature of the investment because many of the more renewable technologies have capital up front in order to save on running costs down the track. So the cost of capital is of fundamental importance here, and there's a great deal that can be done about that, particularly, in my view, with the multilateral development bank. So those are the things which come, as it were, with carbon pricing. Again, different polities will make different choices here, but they're very powerful, good, solid economic arguments for putting a package together which deals with not just the big externality of greenhouse gases, that market failure, but the other relevant market failures as well. The lower is your action outside the carbon price, the higher generally the carbon price would have to be in order to deliver the reductions. And so what are the conclusions? Well, I'm not going to tell you what carbon prices we come up with, but you're intelligent people, so I'll give you some clues as to where we might be going. Well, first, we know that the current promises on the table and nationally determined contributions are together for 2030 in the Paris Agreement, are together far too low. Paris was very honest about that, so it said, well, look, we reconvene, starting almost now, starting next year, to get together to work out how we can ramp up. And examples of good policies are going to feed into that kind of discussion. But we can say we are, as a world, far too low. For 2030, the Paris nationally determined contributions point to an increase from about 50 billion tonnes CO2 equivalent now to 55 or more in 2030. In other words, the Paris promises on the table around a 10% increase or more over the next 15 or 20 years. We actually need a 20% decrease. So that is for the Paris target itself, well below 2 degrees. So that is an indication that we have to ramp up. If pricing policy is, as we believe it is, central to that, it's pretty clear that we're going to conclude that carbon pricing should be a lot higher than carbon prices now, which are, ballpark on average $10 a tonne CO2 or less. So it's clear that there's going to have to be a ramp up in policy all round, including in carbon prices. But we also make the point that they won't be the same everywhere, they'll vary across countries, and that they'll have to rise over time. And that's why we will be thinking of, as it were, corridors where there's a range. If you have very weak complementary policies, you might expect prices to be at the top of the range and so on. So that's the kind of story that we'll be telling. We'll publish in about a month, and then you can read it all and write all about it. But we'd love your thoughts because it's well advanced. That's why we're talking to you, but it is not finished. And so your thoughts on how we express ourselves, what we should say, would be enormously enormously welcome. Let me just make one last point, which I perhaps haven't emphasized strongly enough, and that whatever prices you come up with, credibility is going to be very important. We're talking about investments that take 10, that, you know, might take tens, might take decades in their lifetimes. So where prices are going to go is very important. You can't offer people certainty. The world is not like that. But you can try to work to reduce uncertainty, and the credibility of prices will be very important. And we've learned a bit about that, the role of institutional structures, and not to bang on about my own country, which is not that in that brilliant a state, but it does have climate change legislation and a climate change committee, which helps, as it were, and it looks for targets 15, 20 years down the track. It monitors as to how well we're doing. And those are kinds of institutional frameworks that can give you confidence. Presence of a multilateral development bank can also give confidence. So to say that nobody can give cast iron promises is not to say that we can do nothing about credibility. There's quite a lot that we can do about credibility. Let me leave it there. And I first began working with Joe when we were walking around in Kenya in 1969, arguing about growth theory and capital theory and so on. It's been one of the great pleasures of my life to be working with him ever since. Thank you.
So thank you very much for inviting us and give us this opportunity to talk. We're only about half an hour late, so I'll try to be a little brief in my remarks. That's always a mistake for me to say that, because I am never brief. But Nick has covered most of the issues, and let me just sort of reiterate a couple of points that he raised. The first was that this is a dynamic process, dynamic public economics. And one way to bring that home is that I first became very deeply involved in these issues in the early 90s when I was on the IPCC panel that looked at climate change. And the only mistake that we made in our assessment, the second assessment, was that we underestimated the seriousness of the problem. To give you an example, though, of the caution that we had, was that we were pretty sure that one of the aspects of climate change was not just an increase in temperature, but also weather variability. But the evidence was not sufficiently strong for us to make a strong statement about weather variability. And since then, the evidence has become overwhelming, and now subsequent assessments have emphasized that. But if you look back, where we are today, 20 years, a little more than 20 years later, 27 years later, things have changed so much that it's clear that one could not have solved a optimal dynamic programming problem in the absence of uncertainty and gotten anything right. Solar costs have come down far faster than anybody would have anticipated. At the same time, climate change has proceeded far faster than most people had anticipated. And that, since the IPCC was dominated by real scientists, not by economists, we were very sensitive to the uncertainties in which we were engaged, and it was very much part of how we framed it. One other thing to comment on is that even then, as I say, it was so clear that it was important, and it was enlisting some of the most talented people in the world. And one of the co-authors of a chapter that I wrote for that report was Ken Arrow, who is one of the great thinkers of the last 100 years. And we wrote a chapter on how do you deal with uncertainty. So it was clear that this was going to be with us, and that there was a lot of uncertainty, and therefore one has to think about policy responses within that context. So just three other points. The first is the fact that addressing problems of climate change can be done in a way that is totally consistent with maintaining robust economic growth. And this is obviously particularly important for developing countries because they need to catch up. But it's also true for developed countries like the United States, which are performing very anemically and so are worried about it. So we are very convinced that one can approach the issue of addressing climate change in ways that are pro-growth. Of course, that highlights the importance of addressing the problem in an efficient way, and carbon pricing is an essential aspect of addressing climate change in an efficient way. But one of our senses was very strongly is it's an instrument that's very important, both explicit pricing and implicit pricing, and the use of pricing and cost-benefit analysis, the use of pricing internal to the firm, but that it will have to be accompanied by other instruments. There are a whole range of other market failures, a whole range of concerns like distribution concerns that need to be brought into the analysis, and that while carbon pricing is absolutely essential, it's not the only instrument. And the reason why one needs to take that on board is to make the changes necessary to get down to essentially zero emissions is going to take very large changes in the structure of our society and the structure of our economy. It's going to change not just in the way we produce electricity but also and transport, but how we arrange our living and our work. And much of that occurs in the public sector through decisions about infrastructure. Broadly, our report addresses the major transformative changes that will have to be necessary. It's not the old debate about regulations versus prices. It's really regulations and prices that one needs both of these as important instruments for going forward. The final point I'll make is that I hope that our report will help develop a consensus behind the use of this important instrument of carbon pricing. There are a lot of NGOs, a lot of people have been working on this for a long time, longer, I think this may be the moment where we can finally push successfully so that we will have things like carbon taxes and carbon pricing used throughout the world, throughout our economy. But when that happens, it's important that there's a broad sense of what those carbon prices ought to be. What are the ranges? Not a single number, but a range of numbers. And hopefully our report will help provide a focal point for the international community to start thinking about what kinds of prices would generate the beginning issue that Nick emphasized, what kinds of prices would generate elicit the kinds of responses that would enable the world to achieve the goal of 2 degrees or maximum increase in temperature of 1.5 degrees. And that goal we should keep in mind, and this is an important instrument for achieving that goal. Thank you.
So, Ian, to get the ball rolling, at the IMF, you've increasingly focused also on this issue in terms of global macroeconomics. But one thing that is part of that is the distributional effects that it may lead to, of course, not nationally also, but also internationally. And maybe you can say a few words on that, because it's part of the difficulties reaching an overall path which the world, as, more or less as a whole, can kind of coalesce around.
Right. I mean, we emphasize that when countries are trying to move ahead with carbon pricing, they should emphasize the opportunities, the potential revenues, which we would put at about 1 to 3% of GDP for the typical G20 country, moving with phasing in carbon prices around $70 per ton by 2030. So that creates a large amount of revenue. Much of that can be used for growth-enhancing measures like cutting taxes on labor and capital or funding spending, productive spending like infrastructure. But it's also important to address the sensitivities, the impacts on vulnerable groups. Here we've been looking at the incidence within a country of carbon pricing, and our analysis suggests, for example, that in the United States and in China, that carbon pricing would be moderately regressive, meaning that it imposes a slightly higher burden relative to consumption for lower-income households than higher-income households. But we find the opposite in India. And another important statistic is, well, you know, you really want it, you know, we emphasize that holding down energy prices below their efficient levels, and efficient means not only covering production costs but also environmental costs, air pollution costs, and climate costs, that's a terribly inefficient way to help low-income households, because the huge bulk of the benefits, typically 90% or more, accrue to higher-income groups. But as you do reform energy prices, as you phase in carbon pricing, you do want to help the low-income households. And typically, at least in the early phases, we estimate that you'll need about, say, 8 to 12% of the carbon pricing revenues to compensate the low-income groups.
And internationally?
Well, you know, there's this argument about, well, you know, shouldn't the advanced countries take the main burden of mitigation? Clearly, there are arguments for that, but we still think it's very important for emerging market economies to be pricing emissions. For one thing, 195 countries have made, well, maybe it's 194 now, but there's a large number of countries have made these mitigation commitments, they want to meet these commitments at lowest cost burden on the economy, and the best way to do that is to have carbon pricing at the centerpiece. For a lot of emerging market economies, they simply can't raise sufficient revenues from broader fiscal instruments because of such a high concentration of economic activity occurring in the informal sector. So from a fiscal perspective, it does make some sense for them to include carbon pricing as part of their broader fiscal system. And then in addition, for some countries like India and China, there are very large domestic environmental benefits from moving ahead with carbon pricing. We estimate that if China phased in a $70 per ton carbon price between now and 2030, that would save about 4 million lives over this period due to less exposure to local air pollution. So for a lot of these countries, it's actually in their own interests to impose, you know, some level of carbon pricing because of the domestic environmental benefits and possibly the fiscal benefits, before even counting the global climate change benefits. So when we're discussing equity issues and burdens on different countries, we emphasize it's very important not just to look at the pure economic costs of mitigation, but to subtract off the domestic environmental benefits and also other fiscal benefits as well.
Thank you. Adele, and the U.S. in all of this now, the big question, one of the very big questions. What are the two or three points that you would perhaps like to make in that context?
Well, thank you, Kamal. And first of all, thank you so much for chairing this event. I'm just delighted at your leadership on this topic within Brookings and more broadly. And I want to thank Nick and Joe for their leadership on our not so easily managed commission. I think you guys have done an amazing job, and in part due to the terrific support from the folks at the World Bank. So thank you, John Room and your team for all their hard work. So far, the Trump administration has not yet invited me to come brief them on my views as to what the U.S. ought to do. So I might as well just brief you, since you're sitting here and you all look so bright, and I'm sure you have a straight conduit to the White House inner sanctum. So, you can take advantage of my thoughts as you see fit. I have two pieces of advice to the Trump administration and to Congress. Number one, stay in the Paris Agreement. I think that there's, the U.S., I strongly agree with Secretary Tillerson, the U.S. needs a seat at the table. There's no substitute for U.S. leadership and participation, not just in that multilateral fora, but in the G20 and the other multilateral discussions that include all sorts of economic and national security matters. Of which climate is an important element. The other thing I would say is put a price on carbon. The topic of our event today is carbon pricing in the future of global climate cooperation. I could say carbon pricing is the future of global climate cooperation in many ways. And I would love to see the administration take an extraordinary opportunity to set the climate agenda for this country for decades to come. I think it's an extraordinary opportunity. And I'll tell you a couple reasons why, like economically why and politically why, and then how I think they can do it, okay? So you can decide if you believe me. So let's start with the politics, because we understand this is a very changed political environment in the United States. So why would it be in the interest of the Trump administration and the Republican Congress to work with Democrats on this topic? And I would say, number one, obfuscating and dissembling on climate science is a losing strategy. It's a losing strategy for sure in the long run. I think increasingly it's a losing strategy in the short to medium run politically. I think we see that in terms of the views of young Republicans and the views of moderate, centrist, independent voters, and increasingly Republican voters as well. I don't think the Trump administration is going to be able to deliver on the promises it has placed with regard to the outcomes of environmental deregulation. Okay, you kill the Clean Power Plan, change up the methane rules, walk back from some of the Obama era regulatory programs, you're not going to bring back coal production in Appalachia. We just look at the data, look at the forecasts. I run these models. It's not going to happen. So how are you going to deliver on a better future to coal workers and their communities? I'm going to get to that. I have the perfect answer for you. I think it's an opportunity to show you can make a deal and have a success and work across the aisle and really truly address one of the most critical problems facing humanity and be a global leader, be seen to be the global leader that the Trump administration can be if they choose. I think, this is an opportunity in the palm of their hands. And at the same time, accomplish other goals. If you want to work the carbon excise tax or call it a fee, whatever you want to call it, fine with me, is it paid for into corporate income tax reform or some other broader pro-growth tax reform? Great. You want to do a standalone fee and dividend bill? Great. But you can accomplish those other goals while still serving the environment. And I think that, so those are a few political ideas. Let me give you the economic rationale for U.S. leadership in carbon pricing. First of all, being the biggest market economy on the face of the earth, having the deepest, most liquid, most dynamic, most efficient capital markets on the face of the earth. We have capital ready to be deployed in the R&D and the technological. We can be the engine of innovation, but we have to have the profit motive harnessed appropriately. And that's what you get when you price carbon, if you do it responsibly. We've got the scale, and you know, I really believe that one of the most important conceptual framing of how we price carbon in the United States is how do we create the perfect crucible for forging the technologies that will then be adopted by countries with less means than the United States. And those positive environmental spillovers could swamp whatever we manage to accomplish domestically in terms of emissions abatement. So, okay, what would that package look like? So I think we need the carbon price, again, put it in tax reform. I think we need to be mindful of the effects of those disproportionately burdened. And Ian talked about that, and I think that's true in the United States as well. Many of our social safety net programs are price indexed. So to some extent, those who subsist on transfer income will be a little bit buffered, but we still need to be mindful about low to moderate income households that would have some real new net burden from a carbon tax. And I'm going to come back to the coal workers. You know, just a tiny slice of a reasonable carbon tax could be transformative in coal country and underwrite the pension and medical benefits of coal workers and retirees in the industry. It could fund reclamation of disturbed and impaired lands and waterways as a result of coal mining. We could invest in infrastructure. We could invest in the education and the brighter future for people who live in coal country and whose, you know, generations have depended on the industry. And so those folks could be made better off than they would be even without climate policy, right? So you do this right, you've got so many opportunities for leadership, environmental effectiveness, and pro-growth tax reform. I mean, what's not to love about a positive agenda that way?
Thank you very much. Joe or Nick, would you like to react very briefly to either one of the, or just say we agree?
I agree with them, and I could put this in just for a minute into broader optimal tax theory. Optimal tax theory always took into account, when it's done right, distribution effects, and so you can think about it in those terms. And the taxes that you would impose would be sensitive both to the distribution effects and how you could undo those distribution effects. And so, as Adele pointed out, if you have welfare support programs that actually compensate them, then in some sense, you know, it's more complicated than that in the sense that in certain parts of the country, for instance, those effects will be larger than others, and we don't have sensitive programs that pick that up. But if that were found to be significant, we could obviously deal with that problem. That it's used as an excuse. It's not really a legitimate reason not to go ahead.
But isn't one other reason that the U.S. is questioning is the country distribution of the commitments, I mean, international commitments?
You know, I think the concern that, you know, China's not doing anything, therefore why should we? I think that's mostly BS. It's a smokescreen for not doing anything. And in fact, China is doing
it. Yeah, I mean, Nick and I spend a lot of time in China, and I think both of us would say they're actually very committed to it. And when they, the New Development Bank, that they are one of the five members and is committed to, the whole focus is on climate change.
What about India?
Well, you know, India has now a tax on coal. And this is sort of, people don't realize it. We have a little tax on coal. It funds our Black Lung Liability Trust Fund. And so when India adopted a small comparable tax on coal, you know, after hectoring the Indians for years to do something about climate, they finally adopt a tax on coal, and the U.S. doesn't say anything. That's sort of, I think, unfortunate. And then they raised it, and they're raising it again. So little by little by little, I think the Indians have come to realize, number one, they have a terrible air quality problem it's not just a human health issue, it's a political issue. And I would say that's true in a number of developing countries, not just India. And I think that we should be developing international dialogues and fora to talk about these policies and reward and applaud each other when we do make progress, exchange ideas and techniques and administrative tools and develop methodologies and agreed reporting standards and monitoring approaches around carbon pricing per se. And I think that's another great area of ripe for leadership, whether it's the Trump administration or those in the carbon pricing leadership area. There are a number of really promising areas of international cooperation and coordination.
But it's true that at the moment, the pledges are kind of all over the place. You know, effectively, some countries have to cut emissions below business as usual in 2030 by 40%. Others don't have to do much, maybe cut emissions by 10%. According to our very rough estimates, just based on plausible assumptions about fuel price responses, if G20 countries were to phase in a $70 per ton carbon price by 2030, then a bunch of countries would easily meet their mitigation commitments, Indonesia, China, India, South Africa, and so on. Some other countries would just about or slightly fall short of their commitments, United States, Japan, Germany, whereas others, poor old Australia and Canada, would fall well short of what's needed. So, I mean, at the moment, there is a wide range implicit or explicit carbon prices implied by the commitments. But the idea is that countries will be revising these commitments over time, and presumably there'll be a lot more pressure on countries for whom it's relatively easy to meet their pledges to ramp up their commitments relative to those that are really struggling to meet their commitments, I would imagine.
Just to clarify, when you said 20, you meant CO2e, right? So when we talk carbon prices, it's carbon dioxide equivalent.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's something that,
yeah,
when numbers appear,
yeah,
can create confusion.
Yeah. Could I add a little to what was said about China and India? Because I think it helps understand both about why Paris happened and where we might go. But your first question, can I say something briefly about what Ian and Adele said? Yes, I agree, and I thought it was elegant and convincing. So what about China and India? China peaked coal probably 2014, coal use. And China may well have already peaked emissions. They promised to do it by 2030. I'm in print forecasting they'd do it in the early 2020s. I think that probably was a bit too late. I think it will be before 2020. That's a measure of how fast they've changed and how they're over-delivering on Paris
commitments.
It's a Chinese characteristic in planning, is that you don't commit unless you think you can really do it, which is not a perspective on targets which everybody has. But So China are doing it for reasons that are going to stay. They're deeply worried about climate change. For millennia, water has been a big, big issue in China. The water comes mostly from the Himalayas. They're a coastal population. They're very vulnerable to sea surges, salinization, sea level rise. So they really worry about climate change, and the Politburo is full of people who have serious science degrees. Again, distinguishing them from other kinds of cabinets. But there are other aspects of Chinese polity which we could discuss too, but I'm just making those as observations. Certainly pollution was a very big part of China's story, but also they feel that they, in this new race and technology, to get cleaner technologies, build better infrastructure, more efficient infrastructure, they think they can be rather good at that, and there's some evidence that they are. So these are reasons that are not going to go away. Chinese commitment is clear and strong and will continue. And India, China really changed around 2010, and it was 2009-10. It was built into the 12th five-year plan, built into the 13th, and it'll be built into the next one too. And those, of course, are legally binding. They become law in China. India, the change, I've been working in India for, working in China for 30 years, India for more than 40 years. The change in India in the last 3 or 4 years has been remarkable. And again, it helps understand Paris and why developing countries, emerging market countries, were ready to make commitments in Paris. Finally, the pollution in Indian cities has become a political issue. Far, far too late, since around half of the worst polluted cities, say the top or bottom 25, depending where you look at it, are in India, and Delhi is the worst. So that really has become a political issue. It's published in, pollution is published in the vernacular press. You can see it now on displayed in various parts of Delhi. It's really becoming political. Second, the cost of solar in competitive auctions in India has dramatically reduced. And it's competing coal away. And latest energy assessments as made by the government of India indicate that they are unlikely to need all of the coal power under construction already. We'll have to see how that develops. But that's been a remarkable change. So it's been a combination of pollution and the opportunities that they now see to do things differently. So the drivers in China, I think, are now kicking in quite strongly in India. And, of course, the same will be true of many other parts of the world. And remember, in my own country, the UK, we kill 30 to 40,000 a year from air pollution. One in 2,000 of our population. At least 10 times, perhaps 15 times more deaths than through traffic accidents. So when we talk about India and China, we shouldn't think that those are the only places that suffer from air pollution and where these arguments are strong.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll turn to the audience now, take a few questions rather than one by one. Starting with you, just identify yourself, please, before when you ask your question. And I won't go directly back to the panel, but collect a few questions. And please make it questions rather than...
I'm Mitzi Wertheim with the Naval Postgraduate School. I guess I have two questions. What do you do about people who become unemployed because of this major social change? And how are you going to educate the general public in what I consider a clear, concise, compelling story, not for the educated, but for those who don't focus in on this? And unless you make it something, oh my God, we have to do something about this, it's going to take a long time.
Thank you. There was a gentleman in the middle there somewhere, I think with the beard, yeah, there.
Hi, Don Krause with Citizens Climate Lobby. I just, if any of the panel members could discuss the benefits of or problems inherent with border adjustment tariffs or fees between countries that are pricing carbon or are not pricing carbon. Thank you.
Yeah, while the microphone is over there.
Thanks. I'm Ben Schlesinger. Adele, it's good to see you. Basically a natural gas expert, so I don't know. We're part of the solution, I guess, and as much we're replacing coal or not, that's a different matter. So to your point, Adele, it's maybe more than money. I've spent some time in coal country, and you know, it's effectively invalidating a way of life by stopping coal. We all know the one thing you can do for coal in this country, it's to ban fracking, and coal will fly in as a result, and usage would increase. That's, of course, not going to happen under this or any other administration. So, you know, coal has been marketed out, and it invalidates them. You know, like, daddy did this, my daddy's daddy did this, and all that. So I think that's something you have to deal with. And the lady who asked about bringing in, explaining this and bringing a buy-in to people who, you know, are not highly educated, you know, as we all are, but people who, you know, simply have their views based on their way of life.
Okay. Yes?
Rahul Tonga with Brookings India. We heard about distribution and variance and carbon pricing, and short of a global market, which would eventually, as you said, get to one price, we may have different numbers in different places, and we in fact have different numbers, some many zero, but many non-zero in different parts of the world. How do you see that playing out? Because is it not something that comes back to bite you politically or economically in terms of comparative advantage? How do you see that evolving? Because, yes, we need much higher numbers, as you've alluded, to actually get closer to the 2 degrees or 1.5. But those who take that step are putting themselves out there.
Okay, maybe there's one more there. Yeah. Then we'll take another round.
Len Berman. Joe, I was surprised when you said that you thought we needed to emphasize that it was carbon pricing and regulation. Adele and Aparna Mathur have argued that one of the appealing things politically in the U.S. is that you can substitute inefficient regulation with much more efficient carbon pricing. And I'm not really optimistic that even if there is an optimal regulation scheme that would work, that we could ever get there given the way we actually do regulations in the U.S.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll take one more because of the timing, and then we'll have a last round on the panel.
A rather basic question. Brookings naturally is an economics institute, and so the emphasis is on price. And then we'll see how the world responds in terms of the actual carbon reduction. The other way, I took economics 101 several decades ago. And the other part of the curve is you got the two curves that you all know from economics 101. The other curve is the supply or the quantity. That a alternative approach could well be to put requirements that absolutely demand reductions in carbon use in various everything. Home, industry, utilities, and then see how the world responds to what price is really required to achieve those things. Otherwise, we're guessing one way. The other way, we'll be open and find a surprise.
All right. I think we'll take the last round now, maybe starting with Adele and then ending with Nick.
Sure.
And please don't feel you have to address every question, but particularly those who concern what you said.
Well, let me take something that I've actually given a lot of thought to and I'm doing research on right now, and that's the issue of competitiveness and trade distortions that can result from disparate carbon pricing. So at least in the United States, I think there are at least 5 things we can do to ameliorate concerns about competitiveness. But first, let's put it into context. The actual amount of economic activity that would be displaced or the emissions that would be driven abroad as a result of a unilateral carbon price in the United States is very small. I mean, obviously, it depends on what that price is and exactly how unilateral it is and what time frame you're looking at. But the fact is the vast majority of American activity, economic activity, is not going to be displaced as a result of a price on carbon. But to the extent people are worried about it, and I know this is important, especially in energy-intensive, trade-exposed industries, there are at least 5 things we can do, and some of which might clash a little bit from what Nick and Joe said. First, I think we can start our carbon price modestly. It needs to be environmentally responsible. It needs to be credible, it needs to be effective, but I'm pretty convinced that starting out of the gate with a very high carbon price would scrap capital, it would galvanize opposition, and probably be politically unstable. So my own view is in the United States, we should probably start a little more modestly and ramp up over inflation and give everybody time to adjust politically and in their capital stock and households and corporations alike. I think we can, in the United States, very specifically supplant a future of regulation under the Clean Air Act of greenhouse gases with a price on carbon. And we can do that environmentally responsibly because those regulations will take decades to promulgate, and they're going to take an unceasing series of Democrats in the White House that we've already seen the vulnerability of that regulatory authority to a political shift. So I think we're not giving up much, frankly, if we suspend the rulemaking process in favor of a price on carbon. Third, we can use that carbon tax to fund pro-growth tax reform that makes the whole U.S. more competitive. If you make the U.S. more attractive to capital in investment and saving, that can only be a good thing for U.S. competitiveness. Fourth, I mentioned the diplomatic advantages of a carbon tax as opposed to many other climate policies. I don't know that other countries really knew what Section 111D of the Clean Air Act was and what it was going to produce. California, God love them, have no standing under the Framework Convention on Climate Change. They can't make commitments on the part of the United States government in a subfederal jurisdiction. So there's clear diplomatic advantages, and we should leverage that. And because that competitiveness issue is very much directly dependent on what other countries do. And finally, I think for those industries that are very energy intensive and very trade exposed, and for whom the competitiveness issue is salient and immediate, even with a modest starting price, you can have a carefully circumscribed border carbon adjustment, and I believe such a policy can be made to be consistent with WTO obligations. So, you know, with those five strategies, I think we're good to go, and concerns about competitiveness are not a reason not to do anything.
Thank you. Ian?
Just starting with this issue of, won't a wide range of carbon prices emerge in different countries given different stringency of commitments and the difference in the emissions to responsiveness to pricing. Emissions are a lot more responsive to pricing in coal-intensive countries than countries that don't have coal. And we think it's time that policymakers considered the possibility of complementing the Paris process with a carbon price floor arrangement, particularly among the large emitting countries, so they would agree to impose a minimum carbon price and gradually ramp it up over time as a complement and to reinforce other efforts to meet their mitigation pledges. I mean, this seems to us a good way to go because it provides some degree of assurance against competitiveness impacts. It allows individual countries the flexibility to set prices higher than the floor price, which they may want to do so if they're concerned about the fiscal revenues from carbon pricing, or they like the large domestic environmental benefits from carbon pricing, or maybe it's Sweden, where it's politically more acceptable to have a stiffer carbon price than in other countries. And that's the way we've handled under taxation at an international level in other contexts. For example, in the European Union, we don't force all countries to have the same value-added tax or the same tax on tobacco, alcohol, and energy products. We have minimum tax floors, but countries have the flexibility to set tax rates higher than the floor tax. So we think that's an arrangement that policymakers should be discussing now as a complement to the Paris process. The complication is that you would need to account for, maybe some countries don't fully price all emissions. Maybe they have some exemptions, or maybe at the same time they're adjusting pre-existing fuel taxes. So that can enhance or offset the effects on emissions. But we think it's all analytically quite practical to come up with procedures for taking those other factors into account. And then on this issue of pricing versus regulation, I mean, yes, if the only problem you're trying to address is a pure emissions externality, then it's always more cost-effective to use a pricing instrument rather than combining a pricing instrument with a set of regulations. But for political reasons, maybe the needed pricing is perhaps politically too difficult in a particular country. So that's one reason why you may need to have a mix of strategies. And then, as we've discussed, the other reason is that there are a range of other market failures that you're simultaneously trying to address, particularly technology-related market failures. So you want some complementary measures to be promoting more R&D into emission-saving technologies and perhaps promoting their deployment as well.
Okay. So first, I want to address a couple questions about how you deal with the employed and the fact that there are always going to be shocks to our economy and that force some people from one sector to another. You know, what is very clear is that market economies don't handle that very well, and for good reason. The sectors that have been adversely shocked, they lose their physical capital, they lose their human capital, and that's why efficient government policy has some kind of program, not only to provide, you might say, social protection, for at least the younger people, help them move into a more productive uses. And so that kind of industrial policy is really, I think, an important part, not just in this area, but in every area. And this happens to be a very important area where it's going to be very big, but I think we'll have to address that. The general principle in taxation that it's always better to tax bad things than good things is really illustrated by, you know, the advantage of a carbon tax. But the other side, you know, when you design optimal taxation, you have to design optimal taxation with awareness of all the market failures and all the distributive consequences. And, you know, that really fits into exactly what you're saying. It could turn out to be that the price that you might have to charge to elicit the responses that you need could be very high. There are all kinds of behavioral impediments, and you know, behavioral economics has shown people don't act necessarily rationally. And if you had very large changes in very large taxes, it could be the case that to offset that, you would need to have large redistributions. And the question is, would those be acceptable, and would you be able to do that effectively? So it may be that the optimal policy mix includes an awareness of these and mix combining them together. The same thing, you know, we've known, you know, since the work of, say, Marty Weixman, in a second best world, there are uncertainties associated. There's instrument uncertainty. When we don't know the consequences, it's not always clear whether price or quantity regulation is better. And and that goes back to the general framework that both Nick and I emphasize, it's dynamic public economics. You learn. And the question is, what is the best way to learn? And I think that's something that we should all agree on. So finally, let me answer the question about comparative advantage, and you know, there is going to be some distortion. You know, if you don't have the same price, there's going to be some distortion. But there are all kinds of these distortions, and the real question is both the magnitude and how we learn to live with it. And I think Adele made a very forceful argument is, for most of these, it won't be the dominant effect. But it is an argument for why, if the United States just walked off, that would be a problem. And Adele talked about it from the point of view of the United States. Now, you flip that reasoning abroad, everybody abroad seeing the United States not participating, they would have responses. And among their responses would be to say, we can't allow this as part of the international community. What are the instruments that we have? And they would think about alternative instruments. Among the instruments would be a border adjustment tax. And I, you know, it would be hard to believe that that would not be one that people would not think about. So it seems to me that that is part of the background as people are thinking about responding, and hopefully it keeps us working together. The main motive should be that it's in all of our interest. It's the cooperative spirit. And it's unfortunate that one country has announced that it's not thinking about things cooperatively, but in a non-cooperative spirit. And hopefully the others will put that aside and continue to act in what you might call a cooperative game, and in that spirit. But the alternative framework is a possibility.
Nick, some last word?
Yes. I won't try all of them, but just a few of the questions. Good industrial policy, and we now in the UK have a department for business, energy and industrial strategy. Good industrial policy promotes and facilitates change. It's not there to prevent change. And I think that's an important guiding principle wherever you look, including in coal. I mean, I haven't checked the numbers, but I think the US has lost about 500,000 jobs in retail this century, and probably more than are at stake in the coal, many more than at stake in the coal sector. How do you manage that? It's a similar kind of question. When you talk about coal or shipbuilding in the UK, it was an earlier example, those things have a special feature of place, that they're concentrated in one place. Sometimes that facilitates policy, and I thought Adele gave a very convincing set of policies that could handle what happens, or do your best to manage, I'd say, what happens when your losses occur in one place. But it's about managing and facilitating technical change in a competitive world. And that's the way to keep up employment and to keep up productivity. On prices and regulation, it's not true that prices are always efficient in a world more efficient than regulation, in a world with uncertainty, learning, and economies of scale. And we switched as a world from leaded to unleaded petrol, largely through regulation. We could have had a price for lead. You know, this is what it costs. Going to cost you to pour lead into children's brains. That would have been one way of doing it. But we felt politically it was better to do it that way. But also economically, the clarity of clear deadlines allows people to invest with confidence in technical change and doing things differently. So there's the incandescent light bulb, which has largely been banned in Europe. And the arrival of the LED lighting, which is transforming lighting, cutting emissions and energy use by a factor of around 10, was really accelerated by that action. Good economics. It's not violating some rule. It's about clarity, economies of scale, and so on. So it depends where you look. I mean, I think the instinct to start with prices is basically a good one, but we shouldn't be blanket in saying that. Education, persuasion. We're not very good at it. I mean, we lost the Brexit. You know what side I was on. We lost the Brexit story because we didn't articulate. It's a collection of reasons. I don't want to oversimplify, but one feature of that was poor communication. The Brexit argument ran: "Are you happy with your lot? No. Do you like foreigners? Immigrants taking your jobs? No. And do you like other countries telling you what to do? No. So vote leave." It's 10 seconds, right? And the only thing we had that was remotely close to that was you're much more likely to be treated by an immigrant than be behind an immigrant in the queue. Now, basically, we didn't do very well. What the challenge is to find ways of communicating that are snappy and right. Now, my father would never have dreamt his son would praise a pope, but this
The Pope is very good at that. If we destroy creation, creation will destroy us. You know, God always forgives. People sometimes forgive. Nature never forgives. Now, you can logic chop about, you know, what's this creation? But basically, those arguments are right. So what you have to do is to get much better at that kind of communication. Probably he's doing more on YouTube or whatever. That's not my skill. But we have to think about that, and we've not done very well. Business, faith, and security services are a big part of that story. Business has been doing an increasingly good job in explaining why it matters, explaining what they can do, showing themselves to be responsible, and doing well by that. Faith leaders, I've already mentioned the Pope, and the security service and the military are pretty good on this too. And I don't know how to communicate with this current White House, but I wouldn't mind betting that business, faith, and security might be a way of doing it, brackets plus family. So we have to think hard. It's a very important question. And finally, I want to conclude, this really is the growth story. I mean, infrastructure, if done well, you know, you can always mess things up, but infrastructure, investment now, sustainable infrastructure. Mr. President, surely you'd want the infrastructure to be smart, clean, modern, and robust. You know, it beats dumb, dirty, old-fashioned, and fragile, surely. So that infrastructure story is a big one, and it's shorter to medium term. In a medium term, we set off a Schumpeterian story of discovery and innovation, which we're a real driver in technical change. And we've seen that in waves of technological change in history. And finally, there isn't a high-carbon, long-run growth story because it creates an environment so hostile that it undermines itself. So this is the growth story. If we do it well, if we think it through, if we are smart about policies, infrastructure, and so on. And that, I think, was in a large measure what drove the Paris Agreement. And we have to show now that we really can deliver on that story.
Thank you, Nick. Well, let's give a round of applause to our panelists.